CITR UBC Radio is horribly proud to present an original radio play entitled Tears of Young Ink. Written and directed by Jerry Evitz, produced and engineered by Joe March. The play features the voices of Joe March as the voice of Sanity, Paul Ferberger, Jennifer Smith as Ancient Maud, widow of Sheila Brown in the dual role of Judith and Tracy, Norman Baldwin as nasty and unlovable Gary, Paul Simons as the lovely but troubled Bart, Steve McCoy as the semi-conscious Jimbo, and Jerry Evitz as that damnable former Fleming. Warning, this program contains language that might offend intrinsically bizarre persons of delicate mental balance, so be prepared. The entire production is copyrighted by Needy Holdings, 1980. The setting is an average creative writing class. Like, tell yourself a story or something.
No, I was just laughing to start. I hate this class. Stupidest class. Never seen.
Evening, class.
Hello.
Evening,
hello.
Mr. Ferberger.
Hello.
Well, since this is your fourth creative writing class, I assume most of you have written a couple of things by now. I think we should spend this class hearing you read something you've written. Yes, Tracy?
Mr. Ferberger, do you, want us to, read out our own stuff to everybody?
Yeah. I think that's best. That way we hear it read with the intonation and emphasis exactly where you want to put it. Now then, there's 10 of us in the class. How many have something they'd like us to hear? Okay, who'd like to start? No volunteers? Tracy, how about you?
Oh, me? Sure, I guess so. It's called True Love, and it's a love story. A giant orange sun rose in the east, and Jennifer held the arm of her true love tightly. Look, she said, it's the sun. A mist had risen from the slimy bogs nearby, and several playful Gila monsters scampered over the two pairs of legs as they lay on a soil blanket. This was the moment Jennifer had been hoping would arrive. Everything was perfect. She allowed her mind to drift back to the first time she had met her fiancé. He was a door-to-door parakeet salesman, and even though she already had too many parakeets, she knew she had to invite this handsome, virile, club-footed hunchback into her bungalow. They had coffee, donuts, and sex. She knew he had fallen in love with her right there, on the Arbright counter of her space-age kitchen, and she, well, she was more than a little taken with his thick Latvian accent, his crossed eyes, and his halitosis. She had asked him to marry her right then, and he had accepted, on the condition she buy two parakeets. She was brought from her reverie when he spoke. There is a saying in tiny village of Spastika, where as many, many of wise men who are living, which is this, I don't care what people say, rock and roll is here for to stay. She looked at him lovingly. He always knows just what to say, Jennifer thought. He really is perfect. Oh, Randolph, she cried passionately. Oh, my dear, dear, darling Randolph. Why for is it you always are to be calling me Randolph and my name is not that? You should be knowing by now my name is Snotka. After all, we are to be made woman and husband in just a few hours of this day. He tried to glare at her, but had difficulty knowing which of the two images was the real one. Please don't be upset, she soothed. Don't spoil this oh-so-perfect moment with petty arguing. Names are unimportant when our two hearts are one. She gently stroked his cheek, then nonchalantly wiped her hand off on the dead grass. Hoof and hoof. That is as may be so, but my name until death is to be Snotka. That was my aging mother's name. Got it? He was genuinely irritated. Oh, dearest, Jennifer suddenly moaned. Our first quarrel. She wanted to cry, to flee, to bury herself in the surrounding muck. She closed her eyes and sighed sadly. Her true love focused his attention on only one of the images before him. He took in the horrid sight of this so-called woman, and once more felt that awful, numbing pity that had forced him to agree to marry her. He looked at her thick, silky black hair cascading about her warm, white shoulders. He felt ill as he looked at her tiny upturned nose, her high cheekbones, her perfect chin, and delicate pouting mouth. The feeling of illness only worsened as he allowed his gaze to move down her flawless, perfect body. Phew, he thought. This is the kind of woman for to be marrying myself this day in a few very hours? Phew. Yet even though he knew she would always repulse him, he knew as well he had to fulfill his commitment to her. Jennifer opened her lovely green eyes, and after determining which of Snotka's was seeing her, addressed her beau. I'm sorry, Snot. I really am. I promise never to do it again. Now, please, let's not fight on our wedding day. She gently took hold of his right hand, being careful not to irritate the infected parts. I do so love you, she said passionately. Yeah, he replied. They slowly walked toward the brightly painted church in the last rays of the setting sun.
Comments? Reactions? Come on now, don't be shy. I'm sure Tracy wants to know exactly what you think of her story.
Not particularly.
I have one comment that to be making I would like to. If okay, that is to be all right.
Certainly, Fleming, go right ahead.
That is a story that is quite good in that it true to life is being. Also, the character of Snotka is one of warmth and kindness that is nearly human.
Uh-huh. Anyone else?
Pardoning me if you would once more, Mr. Berg, but may I go and try finding a different kind of desk and chair? This one is not comfortable to me.
Sure, Flem. Well then, who'd like to be next? Gary.
Sure, yeah, I'll go, I'll read. It's entitled Transformation. Greg Smith awoke one morning, only to discover that he was now an apathetic person. The covers had been flung from his body during the night, and even though it was cold in his tiny, cramped room, he just lay on his back, staring at the ceiling. Greg, his mother and father called. Greg, you're late for work. Get up. Get up. His sister came to the door and said in a quiet voice, Are you sick, Greg? Are you too ill to go to work today? But Greg Smith only lay in bed, every now and then breathing. The noises made by his family stopped when there came a very official knock at the front door. That'll be Greg's employer, Mr. Sadista. I know it, whispered his father loudly. And sure enough, when the door was opened, there stood Mr. Sadista. So. Well then, time is money, time's a-wasting. Therefore, money's a-wasting. Where's the boy, eh? Where's the lazy so-and-so? Mr. Sadista stomped through the small apartment, nearly running over the Smiths in his way. He stopped outside Greg's door and knocked loudly. Greg did not reply. He was now apathetic. What can I do, Greg thought. There's nothing I can do. We are born merely to suffer and die. You there, Smith, are you ill, eh? I think not. I think this is purposeful, planned, predetermined, and prearranged. You make me sick. You're not unlike the others of your ilk. You disgust me. I disown you as if you were nothing. I would stomp on you if you were a bug. Are you listening, eh? Eh? Well then, very well then. Good day, Mr. Smith, Mrs. Smith, Miss Smith, all Smiths. Your son is a no-account nothing with a criminal mentality. That is all I shall say on the matter. Good day. The door slammed shut behind Mr. Sadista, and silence reigned in the Smith household. Now Greg had no job and no prospects, but he didn't care. What did it matter? Greg had been supporting his family for years, and now he just didn't care. There was no point in any of it. In the following weeks, Greg rarely left his room. He was fed when his family remembered him, and even then it was only cold leftovers. His mother and father both took jobs, and even rented a room to some lodgers. The lodgers, however, did not stay long. They were fearful and suspicious of the hermit, whom they never saw, and left after several meals without paying a cent. This incident sent Greg's father into a mad rage. He stormed into Greg's room and confronted him. What is this all about? Mr. Smith demanded of his son. What is this all about? Greg just lay on the bed, staring at the ceiling, not saying a word, not hearing, not thinking. There was no point. Finally, Greg's father was so incensed he strangled the inert body of his son. The corpse lay on the bed, the eyes fixed on the ceiling. Mr. Smith left the bedroom and spoke to his wife and daughter. Well, he said calmly, now our lives can return to some semblance of normalcy. The end.
Too much, man. Too much.
To tell you the truth, Gary, it reminds me of something I've read before.
No, you're kidding. Oh, shit, I worked on that thing for hours. Oh, damn it.
Hey, come on, calm down. Have you ever heard of Franz Kafka?
Yeah, I just read a book by him, something stupid about a guy who turns into a giant cockroach or something.
Right, yeah. I think you should go back and read it again. You might notice some similarities.
Oh, hell, shit. I figured I could sell that. Damn, shit.
Mr. Berger, I have a thing to say of this story. Gary, I think this story is quite good. In fact, it is one of the best stories read so far this evening of today. Very good was character of Mr. Sadista. Very good with character of the father person.
Thanks. Loads. I really had to work on that story, you know? Jesus.
Any other comments? No? Okay, then who's next?
Well, I'll read. I should tell you, I didn't write this recently. I wrote it for a different class a couple of months ago. I only remembered it because the person mentioning it just gave me a phone call a few days ago. Anyway, it's called How I Spent Last Summer. Every July, my entire family gathers somewhere for a reunion. These are happy occasions, and no one ever misses them if they can't be avoided. This year, it was my cousin Charlotte's turn to bring the food. Charlotte was rarely let out of the Riverdale mental facilities, as she had once tried to poison an entire church parish by spiking the sacrificial wine with turpentine. But as we say in my family, let bygones be bygones, and Charlotte brought the food. There were huge roasted turkeys and mountains of snowy potato salad. There were fresh crescent rolls and creamy butter. There were cakes and pies and cookies and ice cream, and everything looked so good, no one knew where to begin. Charlotte invited us all to dig right in, but that she'd already eaten at McDonald's on the way and wouldn't be joining us. So dig in we did, and within an hour, the once full picnic tables were empty save for some bones and some tin foil. Well, that food must have spoiled on the journey over, because soon the little kids began to complain of stomach aches. The older people staggered into the shade to rest against the majestic oak trees, and the rest of the adults began to pass out right and left. Within 2 or 3 hours of the meal, most of us were dead. Charlotte did what she could, bringing us warm milk and coffee and soda pop for the children. I was eventually taken to Valley View Hospital, where I spent the rest of my summer holidays comatose. Only Charlotte and I survived that reunion, but you can bet we'll get together next July. She's already volunteered to bring the goodies, and already my mouth is watering.
Oh, wow. Too much, man. Far out.
Well, Judith, that's certainly a competent use of the English language. I'd like to know whether this is fiction or whether the story describes events that really took place.
Oh, it's all true. Over 40 of my relatives died that day. It was sad.
Judith, are you still planning to meet your cousin this July?
Oh, yes. We have a tradition to maintain, you know. I wouldn't miss it for the world. And it's hard to know how many more will be attending. There'll only be the two of us this year, and that might not be much fun.
Right. Well, don't overeat. Are there any comments, questions? Fleming.
I would just like to say, what a story of marvel is this young lady named Judith to have been writing by her. It superb is being. It wonderful is being. I want to weep from joy for hearing it. Her girl cousin Charlie is most lifelike and courageous. Not like many stories is this one. In my home of birth is few artists who could read a story that is well written. Thanks to you, Judith, for the writings of the paper.
Okay, Flemmy. Now, please, if anyone has a valid criticism they'd like to express, Judith, I'm sure, would like to hear those as well. We all learn from our mistakes. Yeah, right. Okay, who'd like to read now?
Yeah, I have a criticism. I thought it stunk. She's illiterate and couldn't even write a postcard. The story was garbage, utter crap, pointless, dull. Besides, I've read a million stories like it before. It was stupid. So is she.
Gary, I hardly think that's a valid criticism.
Sure it is. Her story is shit. It was total shit. It made me want to vomit.
You're not criticizing. Why was it shit?
Why? Well, I'll tell you why. Because she can't write. And the story, it was absolutely shitty, that's why.
Judith, how would you respond to Gary's comments?
Well, Gary's right in some ways, I suppose. The story probably won't get printed anywhere, and nobody else will ever read it again. But I think Gary's shit, so I don't care.
Hey, yeah, right. Right on. Far out.
Okay. Fair enough. Who'd like to read next?
I have a detective story I wrote last week. It's certainly not the best thing I've ever written, but it should give you an idea of my talents in this field. My best work, I suppose, was what I wrote for His Majesty King Edward. That was, of course, a few years ago, but I do like this short story.
Fine. Go ahead, Maud.
Thank you. As I've said, it's a detective story called A Baffling Case. My name is Cressman Bordeaux. I'm a private detective. One of the best. One of the toughest. Yet still surprisingly affordable. Only 2 weeks ago, my most baffling case began. It started when a young lady burst into my office. She was hysterical. I threw an empty water glass at her face, and the pain had the right effect. I told her to get a grip on herself. Then she began to tell me the most bizarre story I've yet to hear since I graduated from Benoit Detective School of Kingston, Ontario. Seems her old man had been seeing some cookie on the sly, and Rita, my beautiful but troubled new client, wanted me to see what was what. She opened her purse and counted out my exact fee in neat rows of quarters. When I saw the $12 on my desk, I knew she meant business. I hit her up for a date to go roller disco skydiving, but she just burst into laughter and left. So I figured she was a no-go. That was fine with me. I had a job to do. I started by checking out her husband's business. His name was Bill Manure, and he was a spot remover by profession. I soon learned he was moonlighting as a Phase 4 Series A-4567893/4 data system analyzer whenever he could get work. His bimbo, a woman named Fredrina Van Hoopel, was heir to the Van Hoopel cosmetics fortune and had a rare kidney disease that would cause her to shuffle off this mortal coil in just 60 or 70 short years. This was starting to smell fishier than the annual St. John's Cod Fisherman reunion, but one thing puzzled me. When Rita had been in my office that morning, she wore heavy makeup, and yet, when she cried with laughter, her mascara hadn't run. It had barely moved. It was only a matter of days before I came to sudden realization that Rita and Fred must be the same person. A few quick phone calls confirmed my suspicion. Only one thing remained in that damn shadowy haze, the unknown. Why? Why had Rita wanted her husband tailed? Why would she deliberately hire someone to lay open the bare facts of the case? I had my answer when Rita returned to my office just 12 days after her first visit. I took her by surprise when I asked the direct question. Why the charade, Toots? She looked at me with those beautiful baby blues and said, I just plain forgot that I, Rita Manure, was an actual fact. Also me, Fredrina Van Hoopel. Sorry about that. You can keep the $12. I have to go. I have a bus to catch. And she hightailed it out of my office, leaving me with all those loose ends tied together in a pocket full of change. Sometimes when you're a private detective, things can be pretty hectic, but I wouldn't trade jobs with anybody. Not for all the quarters in China. I put my feet up on my desk and waited for my next customer. Well, what do you think?
Garbage. Rubbish. Trash. Filth. Excrement. Waste. Sewage.
Gary, let's not turn this class into a name-calling session.
Her story was no good.
Why don't you take a long walk up a short pier, you young savage?
Please, people. Does anyone have any serious, unbiased opinions?
Myself, Mr. Fartburger, has only one comment to be making on this fine and James Dandy defective story. Maud, you have moved my heart around inside my body I am in with this story so terrifying and ruthlessly horror-bringing. My flesh is made of geese, and my chattering teeth vibrate like my wife.
What did that damnable foreigner say?
He liked your story.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
Welcome, you are being.
Okay, folks, moving right along here once more. Who'd like to be next?
I will. I'll read now, Paul. Me.
All right, Bart. Go ahead.
Well, this is a sort of fantasy. I just saw an old Edward G. Robinson picture the other night, and I got to thinking about the women who used to hang around with all those gangsters, and so I wrote this. But it's just fiction, right? And it's not real life, but anyway, it's called I Was Al Capone Steady, and this is it.
Oh, Christ.
You shut up. Isn't he rude? Anyway, it's called I Was Al Capone Steady. I first met Al Capone when I was 4 years old. He gave me a piece of candy and patted my head, tugging hard on one of my pigtails. He seemed to be such a nice man, in such nice clothes. How was I then to realize that just 12 short years later, I would be inextricably bound to this sinner, this saint, as his moll, his babe, his sweetheart, his lover, his steady girlfriend? Al and my father had been in school together. Al was a big, tough boy for his age, and used to protect my father. For this token of friendship, my father merely had to give Al his trolley money, his lunch, his homework, and his fine hand-knitted sweaters. Once, Al heard that some teacher had made my father stay after class for being late, and only a week later, the teacher received 2 broken legs, 3 fingers cut off one hand, and a dead cat epoxied to his bum. My father never forgot all of Al's kindnesses, and so, on my 16th birthday, he gave me to Al. Al and I had a great time for the first few weeks. We were inseparable. I helped him rob banks, kill his enemies, and pay off the coppers. But as the saying goes, all good things must come to an end. And so it was for us. The FBI sent my beloved Al to the big house, where he eventually died of tertiary syphilis. I went on to become a famous drunk. But I'll never forget those glorious days we spent together when I was Al Capone Steady. So, what do you think? Was it good? I think it's just kind of silly, but then I do value everybody's opinions, or well, just about everybody's opinions. Did you all like it, or did you all hate it, or what?
A good story. One could see that the author, which is you, Bart Being, was excited by this idea so novel. Very good story. So good that it nearly makes me fall off this very chair because of being so amazed.
Ooh, thanks, Flemmy.
Far out story, man. Too much. Too much.
Any other relevant comments? Yes, Gary.
Yeah, if you liked it all so much, why don't y'all chip in and get the foul thing published, lousy bunch of fascists?
Gary, why do you continue to make this a personal thing?
I dig what you're jawing about, Mr. Paul Furberger, and I know what you're saying. Hey, Gary, baby, like, don't get into some sort of freaked out state of mind just because you don't dig somebody else's headspace. Like, your story was cool, really far out. But wow, man, get it together or you won't, I forgot what I was going to say.
Yeah, I wonder why. Jimbo, now that the floor is yours, do you have a story you'd like to read us?
Huh? Oh yeah, sure, man. Let me find it here. Oh, far out. Here it is. I wrote this today. Where was it yesterday? Maybe it was last week. I don't know. Time's all relative, right? Anyway, good old Albert pointed that one out. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Jimbo, what's it called?
Huh?
Your story. What's it called?
Story? Sorry, man, I don't...
The story you're holding. The one you wrote sometime in the last 20 years. The one you're going to read us. What is it called?
Wow, blow me away, man. I still... Oh, right. Right. What's the story called? Well, I guess you could just call it a great story. Bonnie Prince Charlie kicked at the safe until his foot was broken. Phi Beta Kappa, he shrieked, jumping up and out. To the fairy king a daughter, he shrieked louder. Suddenly to his right appeared a very large black dog. The animal rushed at him as if to attack, and then turned into a small tree. Poetic justice, quoth Machiavelli, who then hopped onto the rear of the nearest approaching chariot and was whisked away. The driver of the chariot was Jean-Paul Sartre, who demanded to know why anything it deemed. But this was only a passing phase, as the chariot was lifted off the ground and hurled end over end into a pool of bubbling mozzarella. John Fitzgerald Kennedy was to die in Houston that very year, and again a week after that. There ain't no such thing as ghosts, said a one-eyed, green-toothed, and deformed sailor man who spun the wheels of his rowboat and headed to Istanbul, Kafiristan, and Zellers. But what, finished William Claude Dukenfeld, as he slid into second base, and with a man on first and something similar on third, he knew it was a long way to the bathroom. In Tokyo, a top-level meeting was being held in the basement. You were not invited, and neither were you. There was once a very great man, but he decided that orange was really blue and that deciduous forests had feathers. Not only that, lapdogs have no lap, but they can run it. A pregnant woman holds no ocelots in her womb. The list, as the saying goes, goes on, and then stops. The Beverly Hillbillies bought themselves a couple of thermonuclear devices, and in a fit of cunning, wiped Moscow off the map. Moscow, quite understandably, was upset and asked the Americans to put them back. No way, said a highly ranked and mustachioed TV personality, and with that stuck a wad of chewed gum on the side of the French president's head. 16 whirling and cavorting psychiatrists suddenly found themselves on the lost continent of Atlantis, the founders of chartered accountancy. There were no payphones, however, and they died of thirst. James Earl Ray was elected president of the USA due to a typographical error. Within the next million years, mankind will develop an additional toe, a third and fourth ear, and finally, the ability to vacation near Acapulco at will. The pineapple will become revered and eventually forgotten, except by one old lady in Nantucket. She, quite rightly, has never heard of pineapples. I have never heard of pineapples, she said recently. And mice will be the size of mice. Marijuana, once said to be harmful, has been discovered to be harmful, but only if one has anything to do with it. This news was a great relief to the Inuit and Mr. Jim Spriggs of Port Alberni, British Columbia. Said Mr. Spriggs, swallowing cats is harmful. The police still search for clues.
Now that was garbage.
Jimbo, what were you trying to say?
Oh, wow, man. Bum me out. Too much. Like, how am I supposed to know? Like, I just wrote it, you know? I didn't study it. Too much. Too much.
Anybody have anything to say?
This story is such of the kind that leaves me speechless.
A load of addled nonsense, if you ask me.
Go on, I dare you. Tell me if that wasn't total shit. Go on, tell me.
Okay, okay, our time's just about up. Is there just one more story?
I am having one. It is a story from my native lands, being called Tall Ben. Once upon long time ago, lived a tall fellow with many black whiskers all over chin and lips. This tall fellow was called by name to be Ben, and he was biggest man to live in whole Balkan areas. When born, he was already much more tall than his father, who had to assemble whole village to give young Tall Ben the many beatings he was deserving when out of hand he got. One day later, Ben was older and working as blacksmith to earn money to eat and buy cheap vodka. He was a good blacksmith enough so that he once put iron shoes on the feet of 80 horses in one afternoon. Such was the work this tall man could do and desirable. The mayor then came into Ben's workhouse and said, "Go to army enlisting place, Tall Ben, and join forces. You would win many battles, even fighting alone." So Ben went off and joined army. 2 weeks of days later, he was trampled to death by a team of yaks pulling schoolgirls to mass. This goes on showing that clever poet Mikhail Togolodesense was not only right when he said, "The oxen may be harnessed, but they will still walk over riverbeds to find corn husks which await hungry mouths." Such is the way, whether oxen or cattle or yaks even, are running over your body to death.
Okay, well, you might, I don't think I can add anything to that.
That's only one of the two decent stories I've heard here tonight.
Really? Are you serious?
Sure, it was terrific.
What did you like most about it, Gary?
I'd have to say the ending. I was ever glad when that garbage was over.
No.
Goose, clown, gastel.
Turkey. If I might get a word of comment in. I heard so many good stories of fine writings here tonight that were so most wonderful. But this story of mine, I would say, was I searched for a word.
Pathetic?
This last story was the best of all.
Okay, that's it. That's it. Go home. Next class, everybody bring in a piece of nonfiction. It's got to be a true life account of something that happened directly to you. Any questions?
Do suicides count?
Yeah, they do, you stupid bastard. Everybody get out. See you next week. You have just heard Creative Longing, an original radio play by Jerry Eberts, produced and engineered by Joe March, and featured the voices of Jennifer Smith, Norman Baldwin, Goodard Sheila Brown, Paris Simon, Steve McClure, Jerry Eberts, and Joe March. A special thank you to Mr. Dressup. Creative Longing is copyrighted by Moody Holdings 1980.
That was garbage. Disgusting garbage. Filth. Slime. Oozing, festering, crawling, loathsome, vile, putrid, sickening, awful, maggoty, rotten,